Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome. Before we begin, I feel compelled to ask the listeners to take their counters that track the number of times they've encountered the term antimetaboly each day and set them to zero. Although the term antimetaboly might not figure too prominently in today's discussion, today's author calls it, quote, yet another good word, a great word maybe, end quote. So that we're all on the same page, your antimetaboly tracker should now be at 3. Well, make that 4. With that taken care of, hello, my name is Nathan Smith, a host for the New Books Network. Today I'll be speaking with Eldridge Priest, associate professor at Simon Fraser University, about his new book, Earworm and Event, Music, Daydreams, and Other Imaginary Refrains, which was published in March of this year, 2022, in the Thought in the Act series of Duke University Press. So to introduce the book and to steal some good words I wish I had written, in Earworm and Event, Eldridge Priest questions the nature of the imagination in contemporary culture through the phenomenon of the earworm, those reveries that hijack our attention, the shivers that run down our spines, and the songs that stick in our heads. Through a series of meditations on music, animal mentality, abstraction, and metaphor, Priest uses the earworm and the states of daydreaming, mind-wandering, and delusions that it can produce to outline how music is something that is felt as thought rather than listened to. Priest presents Earworm and Event as a tate besh, two words bound together with each end meeting in the middle, where Earworm theorizes the entanglement of thought and feeling, Event performs it. Throughout, Priest conceptualizes the earworm as an event that offers insight into not only the way human brains process musical experiences, but how abstractions in the imagination play key roles in the composition and expression of our contemporary social environments and more than human milieus. Unconventional and ambitious, Earworm and Event offers new ways to interrogate the convergence of thought, sound, and affect. Now, that blurb would have been a far clearer introduction than my rambling about anti-metaboly counters, but I wouldn't have been able to use the word anti-metaboly, which we're now up to 6. So, with that, Eldridge Priest, welcome.
Thank you, Nathan. Thank you for inviting me to have this chat with you. And thanks for the introduction. That's great. I think, yeah, 6 is what you counted of that word.
As long as we're including my inevitable mispronunciations, and I think people get it, have people, if people have read the book, I think they'll start to get the gist.
Right, so, right, of course.
So to begin with, I was just wondering if you could say a few words about yourself, your career, what you work on, including your, I believe you're also a composer and improviser.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So where to begin? I often like to say that I grew up in the Yukon, actually, because it sounds terribly exotic. I don't know that it actually is, but it's a place that is like the Alaska of Canada, I suppose, right? It's this frontier land. So, I grew up there, but then I moved all over Canada, actually, for a long time, and I was studying jazz music when I was younger, And the places that I ended up landing to study were in Edmonton, in Nova Scotia, a small town called Antigonish, and eventually in Toronto. Then I went on to study composition with people like Linda Catlin Smith, who's a Toronto-based composer, and I did grad studies in composition in Victoria, at the University of Victoria, with a fellow named Christopher Butterfield. But during my studies in Victoria, I started doing other studies in literary theory, for example, and I was taking courses on Derrida. And as I was finishing my master's degree, I started to think that I wanted to pursue a PhD, but not in music. And strangely for me, I was married at the time. I was going to go to Ottawa with my then wife and start a new degree in cultural theory. And so the marriage fell apart, but the program for my studies was still in place. And I found myself doing my doctoral work in Ottawa, the capital of Canada, for those people who don't know what Ottawa is. So as I was there, I wrote my dissertation, which became my first book, Boring Formless Nonsense, which was, I think, subtitled Experimental Music and the Aesthetics of Failure. I guess it's been 10 years now.
Yeah, I think so, it was 2013, correct?
That's right. Just about 10 years. So in that book, that was me still dealing with my past as a composer of experimental music and as an improviser. I suppose the idea of failure had been swirling around me, let's say, career-wise, but also in the kind of aesthetic approach that myself and my peers were taking. Most of the people I write about in the book are peers, people that I know, some people that are actually very successful and some are not so successful. But the whole idea of failure in that work, it was, I suppose, a kind of conceit of trying to understand how there is a type of musical practice that one could understand as engaging with expectations that would never be fulfilled. I was trying in that book to not play so much with the idea of failure is success, although the book does abound with paradoxes of all sorts, and
I think does this one as well.
Yes, yeah, in different ways, I suppose. With that book, I like that book. It was the form of Boring Formless Nonsense took the shape of a progressive arc from boredom, which was a very typically scholarly approach to understanding kind of the cultural history of boredom and contemporary music. Then the work on nonsense, the work on formlessness takes a more fragmented view. Eventually the text starts to resemble the work that it's describing. So it's full of footnotes and footnotes within footnotes. And then lastly, the nonsense chapter kind of goes off the rails and it becomes extremely metafictional in some way. So I'm writing about events that don't really happen, about composers that don't exist, pieces that don't exist, all to demonstrate a certain kind of logic that music gets away with in a certain sense. That's not the book we're talking about today, but I guess I'm talking about it to set up a trajectory of where I'm going now with the work that I do. I suppose parallel to all of this, I could mention that I've been working with some colleagues, David Cicchetto, Mark Carew, Rebecca Sheldon, and Ted Hebert, and we've been working together as the Occulture, what I like to refer to as a theory band that was originally based in Toronto, but now with the members of Ted Hebert and Rebecca Sheldon. They're in Bloomington, Illinois, and Seattle, Washington as well. But this group was a group that put on a number of conferences called Tuning Speculation that ran from 2013 to 2019, and it was always held in Toronto apart from one iteration in Bloomington. And at these conferences, we would present works that were very playful and performative in their nature. And the aim of that conference was to produce experimental forms of knowledge making and knowledge dissemination. Although the dissemination was perhaps not so experimental insofar as we were still giving papers at conferences, but these papers were intentionally speculative, comedic, let's say, as well. So with that group, I ended up writing a book called Ludic Dreaming. I think that came out in 2017. That was a book that took a lot of the writings that we had been, well, let's say, quote unquote, performing at Tuning Speculation and put them into a book format that played around with the logic of dreams to try to interrogate the way you might think about sound in what we called contemporary techno-capitalism, or techno-culture, I believe is the word we used. So that brings us up to, I guess, more or less where I am now. I'm, as you said in the introduction, I'm associate professor at Simon Fraser University. I work in the School for the Contemporary Arts, which is quite lovely because this school is an interdisciplinary school. I teach a lot of the grad courses in theory. I teach a little bit of music composition as well, but otherwise, the nature of this, I guess, department where I am is so flexible that I can get away with doing the kind of work that I do that turns into things like Earworm and Event and other writings that I've done as well, which we can chat about if the occasion arises.
Sure. No, that sounds fantastic. It's fascinating how many of the types of things that you've been thinking about for this long stretch of time are being articulated in these different forums. And I guess that kind of does get me a little bit to my first question, which you may have just answered, which was, how did you get into this project? Because you intimate that it's been brewing for a decade or so. So are these, is that trajectory you just unfolded for us something of the gestation period for this book?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I finished the first book, like I said, it came out in 2013. There were discussions in the book about distraction. I was writing a little bit about Suzanne Langer's work, and I had started a couple of new projects that ended up becoming a chapter in this book about, particularly the chapter about earworms that was probably just after the initial Boring Formless Nonsense, or after Boring Formless Nonsense came out. So all of that, those kind of ideas were there, like I say, almost 10 years ago, but it was through the work with the Occulture and Tuning Speculation that some of the event side of the book developed. And so yes, very much I'd say that really, yeah, it was about 10 years in the making, this work. Mm.
Yeah, no, as I guess kind of as an aside before we go further, because I kept, when I was reading this book, I'm not sure, later on when I was preparing the podcast to, like, how do we capture some of these more speculative aspects of your work in this podcast, which seems so non-speculative, like it's so, you know, kind of straightforward. I'm saying, like, hey, vaguely, what's your argument? Who are you? Instead of asking, like, what were you, you know, like asking the more speculative, emergent questions that your work kind of touches on. And I was just thinking, have you? I'm not sure. Maybe a kindred spirit with. Do you know Phil Ford?
Phil Ford. I don't know Phil Ford.
Okay. You just kept saying Bloomington, and I went to Bloomington, Indiana, and he's a musicologist there. He runs the podcast Weird Studies. I somewhere in my notes I wrote down, I think Weird Studies would do a much better, like a much more, I don't know if faithful is the right word, but I would play nicely into that.
Right.
But, okay. Yeah, it might be something to reach out to. You guys would certainly have a lot in common.
Okay,
interesting. But anyway, to get back to the text, or to digress. So as I was just kind of noting, this text plays with and problematizes what you might call form and content quite a bit. It's split into two parts, the Tate-Besch binding, and the two parts differ in style and method, and you experiment and reflect on the modality of these approaches. So before we like dive into something like the content, could you say a little bit more about the form of expression you took for this book?
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know if people know what the word Tate-Besch refers to, head to tail.
I did not until I looked up how to pronounce it.
Right. I mean, so it's a binding that has one book written one way, and then you flip the book over, and there's another book or other text written the opposite way, so that the ends of each book meet in the middle. And, you know, I mean, this is I used the word conceit already before, but it really is a formal conceit that I very consciously employed because while I was writing the book, as I said, as we just discussed, it took about 10 years. There was a number of voices at work in the composition of the text. And as I was nearing the end of the writing process, or what I began to realize was the end of the process, I said, okay, there's this material. It's a book, but I don't know how to put it together. The tone changes, the mood changes, the approaches change. Although there are some similarities between certain what became chapters in the book, so. This I felt like an impasse actually for quite a while, and it dawned on me actually quite suddenly one day that I should actually just keep the book in two halves. And it happened that I was, or that on my bookshelf I have this stack of what are, maybe people know about this, ace books from the 50s to the,
yes.
Yeah, to the 50s,
oh,
to
yeah.
The 70s, right? Wrote what they called ace doubles, right? So these sci-fi novels that would be one novel one side and another novel the other side. And I don't remember looking at those, but I remember it just sort of clicked and said, I think I have to do this as one book, but split into two halves. And I really want this to be bound Tate-Besch. And so I spoke to the series editor, and he spoke to the editor at Duke and told them what I would like. And amazingly, Duke was very thrilled about it. They were totally on board, and they were excited about it. I think the design team did a great job as well, just making it look good. And ultimately, I think, I don't know, maybe some people disagree, but I think it does serve the formal conceit does serve a kind of purpose of letting the thoughts modulate from one side to the other. And in the book, there are a couple times I reference, I make reference to the other side, the flip side of this book, in order to highlight places where there's a little bit of, let's say, leakage or seepage between the two modalities.
Yeah, no, that's it's funny that you bring up the ace publishing, because I believe that the only other time that I had read something like that, or like, I, you know, that I had experienced this form, or the first time I had experienced it was I think it's an ace publishing, it's on my shelf in the other room, but it's a Samuel Delaney Nova, and I can't remember what the other smaller story was. So it actually was this exact
interesting
place. Yeah,
they're, I guess they're the contemporary model, although the binding, that kind of binding goes back many, many
sure
centuries, I believe, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, when I looked it up, I got a lot. I learned a lot about the history of stamps, trying to figure out how to pronounce the word. Yeah, it was, how stamps were laid in books upside down. Yeah, so cool. No, yeah, it's an interesting aspect of the work, you know, because in some sense the earworm bit is a little bit more amenable to what we're doing here. Something like, you know, expository prose has more typical discursive trappings, although it also has its more event-esque wanderings. And the event side, similarly, I guess a little bit more on the dreamy, the speculative side. But there are the moments, like I think it's in the first chapter. So you have like little colloquia, or I can't remember the exact word you use, where you're like, yeah, we're just like, hey, let's talk about Suzanne Langer and, you know, have a little bit more expository stuff so that you can continue the more dreamy play.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So, yeah. No, but yeah, it's certainly a fun read. But beyond just the form, and we might have a little bit more time to talk about that when we get to the event side. To start a little bit with the content of Earworm, the first chapter focuses primarily on the work of mid-20th century philosopher Suzanne Langer. And you put it in, you know, the trajectory of, let's say, her dissertation advisor, Whitehead, and William James, Deleuze, and then Masumi as being kind of another modern inheritor of that lineage. Can you unpack... for our anti-metabolic listeners, the notions of her philosophy that interest you, such as the term semblance and forms of feeling, and what special role music plays in her aesthetics.
Right. Okay, sure. I mean, Langer's an interesting, I think she's an interesting thinker. I actually worked on her, or worked with her work, back in the early 2000s, I was fascinated with her concept of virtuality. It was different than the kind of virtual that I was looking at with Deleuze's work. And it was also something that predated it, right? And it was this American philosopher, so not French. It was very surprising. Then I kind of fell out of interest, or her work fell out of interest for what I was doing. And then... it was as I was finishing my doctoral work, I was in Ithaca at Cornell, and I was a visiting scholar there. And Masumi, actually, Brian Masumi, happened to be a resident for the semester. And I sat in on his class, and he was working on his book, Semblance and Event. And I was like, oh, right, Suzanne Langer. I haven't thought about her for a while, because Suzanne Langer features in that work of his. She features in that work quite a bit. So kind of rekindled my interest. And again, it was still at first it was this idea of virtuality that I came back to, the concept of semblance, which is her way of describing what is essentially a perceptual illusion, right? So semblance for her is crucial to the way in which we perceive art, specifically art. And for her artworks, I mean, perhaps a little bit of a conservative form, she follows the traditional distinction of the arts into literature, dance, theater, music, etc. But for her, she suggests or argues that every art form produces a specific kind of illusion, a specific kind of semblance, isn't it? And she uses the word semblance to allude to, I think it was Schiller who brought up the concept of shine.
I believe that's right.
Schilling. I always forget which one it is. Although she does credit Jung at one point for the term semblance, like in her later work in her Mind trilogy, which is kind of strange. So this idea of semblance was fascinating to me because it was a kind of virtuality that we experience as not as something that is a delusion, but as something that is completely affirming, let's say, in its unreality. We're never fooled by the illusion, except maybe in some cases. But for her, essentially, this is how we perceive art. We perceive art as this illusion, which I then took up as a way of saying, well, it's actually an abstraction. We're perceiving an abstraction directly. And I developed a way in that chapter specifically of trying to think about semblance and its connection to affect. I think the subtitle of that chapter is The Semblance of Affect. For me, I'm still interested in music. I still write about music and perform music and write music. So Langer's theory, what was interesting to me was that it was based, like her theory of semblance and what she ends up calling sort of significant form is based in her readings and theories about music. And that goes back to her work in 1942, titled Philosophy in a New Key. She has this wonderful chapter in there about the significance of music. And it was through that chapter that she then developed her follow-up book, Feeling Informed, to develop her theory of art, her general theory of art, based on her insights about music, right? So to me, I found that utterly fascinating. And the fact that for her, all the arts, the semblances that they produce, the illusion that they produce, are illusions of what she talks about as the illusions of the form of the inner life. So for me, this was a connection to the kind of Deleuze studies that I was doing on affect theory. And Langer had this idea about the arts producing symbols of what she called the inner life, or of organic processes. And so in that chapter, the first chapter of the earworm side of the book, of my book, deals with Langer's idea of semblance, and I try to update it by bringing it into line with some of the work of Deleuze and ultimately with Brian Massumi, because he had, I think, Semblance, End of End, had just come out. And then I tried to radicalize it a little bit more by suggesting that something about music intensifies this illusory process and lets us see abstractions more directly. And actually, music is a way of, how would I say this, of intensifying our powers of abstraction. So that's, I guess, a quick breakdown of that chapter and what I aimed to do in it.
Yeah, no, that's, I thought I had inherited some old books from an older professor, and I'm looking over and I'm like, oh, there's Suzanne Langer. And like, he'd give me a couple of these texts. I have not personally dug into them as well, but like what you're saying really resonates. I think that it provides like a nice, your kind of like modernization of it fits really nicely with it. You know, like I'm reminded of the bits in Deleuze where he talks about, or I guess it's a tension that I never quite know how to read between whether sound has some special sound / music has some kind of special purchase on revealing the virtual or intensity or something like that, or whether that kind of like reaffirms kind of like as he says in Difference of Repetition, like thinking the transcendental from the empirical, you know, like our empirical notion of sound, how could that possibly transcend or not transcend, but like be the basis of our transcendental understanding of it. And it's it seems to be a similar type of thing as you were kind of outlining with Langer, where she's seeing music at least in its ability to cull these abstractions or to produce it, to have some sense of, have a particular relation to, you know, the dynamic organic processes.
Yeah, I do think that she recognized that music was exemplary in that respect. She was a musician, a cellist as well, and although I think her tastes were fairly conservative, I draw that conclusion based on just her sources and her references. And the fact that even though she was writing in the 50s and 60s about art, she was not writing about the avant-garde.
Yeah, right.
Which is, I think, what I tried to update. And sure, probably what I do with her work, she wouldn't like.
Yeah, you know.
But I mean, that's what happens when words are printed on pages. They become material of a kind.
Yeah. We can't help but produce our own little monstrosities, as I surely am of your work as well, you know? But okay, yeah, that's great. So let's take a dive into chapter two, which kind of transitions a little bit more into the culture studies critical approach, and looks specifically at earworms and the relation to contemporary capitalism. So what roles do distraction and other states of these so-called useless thoughts or modes of thought play in our contemporary world? And how do earworms fit into that class of types of thought?
Right. Well, that chapter was one that seems to be a favorite of some people. It does a certain kind of scholarship that I really like, although it does have its moments of flaring up into the gestural figurative at some point as well. But in that chapter, I'm really looking at trying to understand the earworm not just as a like a cognitive deficit, which is, or a not deficit, a cognitive excrescence, maybe I could say, an anomaly, which is kind of how it's been treated in some of the literature, the scientific literature. It's a byproduct of thinking. It's something strange. It's excessive. Hence, it's maybe uselessness, right? But I try to look at it as more of a technical affair, and the way I do that is I kind of wind through Bernard Stiegler's idea of techniques that our thinking is something that is co-evolves with the mediations that we produce and that then ultimately produce a kind of thought. And so I guess I take this approach where I look at the technogenesis of earworms to understand that actually we can see how they arise not just by virtue of some kind of cognitive tick, if you want to put it that way, or psychological error, but they arise because we are coupled with machines that repeat and or techniques for repetition. And one way we can look at that is the, you know, the CD players, iPod players, radio, the recorded form of music is such that it is highly repetitive. But then I also make this point of saying, like, well, there's technologies of repetition, but we might understand music itself, you know, music, putting in scare quotes for now, music itself being a kind of technology that utilizes repetition. And I draw a little bit on Langer to suggest that that what music does is it draws out abstractions. And these abstractions are ones where we perceive repetition as a kind of living form, and so I suggest that music is a type of lived abstraction that is actually intensified by our media. So the repetition that is already in musical forms, and even the idea of a note, is a type of repetition of a difference between the oscillating air pressure and the waves that are emitted is a kind of repetition. So right down to the very materiality of sound, there's a repetition that music sort of captures, crystallizes. Then media, I suggest, take up that same type of, or take up that abstraction and then can say, like, it speciates it and puts it into the types of listening conditions where we listen, and I suggest listening to it in the background is one of the most, let's say, effective ways by which that musical abstraction gets intensified through media when we actually listen. I think I used the word listening away from it at some point. So this is the idea of how I think distraction works in the development of our understanding of earworms. And ultimately, I then take the idea of the earworm and its relationship to cognition as one that can be related to contemporary notions of cognitive capitalism, where the fact that we have a brain that is always working, that is, as neuroscientists are saying now, is never fully at rest, because even at rest, the mind is still wandering, daydreaming, right? And I get into that in this chapter, but also later in the book. But ultimately, I guess I'm after some idea of understanding how earworms get entangled in the practices of cognitive capitalism, where there's a type of harvesting of our capacity to remember. For example, we don't voluntarily remember. We can't help but remember, and earworms, through those the way that music extracts this kind of power of repetition to contract time into these kind of events, we can see how. And I think the specific example I give is about something called called Earworm, the Musical Brain Trainer. It was originally developed by Berlitz, and it was a way of using music, musical phrases, to try to learn language. And their idea being that let's hijack or conscript this power of music to abstract and to produce repetition, to get someone to learn a language. But a way in which I ended up suggesting this is a kind of useless thinking that gets tries to be made utile, let's say, is kind of doesn't work, because it also is, I suggest that earworms are also unruly, right? You can't really control when they happen. This is the big deal that pop music writers try to pursue, is like, how can we produce catchy melodies, melodies that will stick in people's mind, and et cetera, or jingle writers, et cetera, right? But there's no formula. There's a kind of formula, but it's not a guarantee. There are all these other conditions, I think, that are required for an earworm to happen. But because I suggest that because they are also unruly, they don't quite let capitalism, these sort of capitalist forces that want to harvest this kind of surplus labor from our very capacities to remember, and it ultimately doesn't satisfy these things, I guess, right? Because it keeps going longer than you want it to go, which is often our experience of earworms. And ultimately, I think I make the argument that we can think of earworms as perhaps what is the fate of useless thinking. And I draw on Baudrillard, actually. Late Baudrillard writes about thinking being relieved from its need to be meaningful, to make sense, as perhaps what is the most kind of radical form of thought. And actually, an essay that he wrote called Radical Thought, he suggests that the aim of thinking is not to make things more sensible, but to make the world more unintelligible, and ultimately to make thinking a kind of poetic activity. And so I get into this weird place at the end where I kind of say, well, in some sense, it seems like the earworm is this kind of form of radical thought. But is this what radical thought looks like? Is this poetry?
Yeah, no, that's I'm going to have to go back and read that ending, because I kind of forgot that gets twisted at the end. If this is a radical thought, does it end up being something like poetry? I'll have to go back and muse on that. Just in hearing you talk about this, you clarified the one thing that, like, as I was reading, I think you stage it well. I guess that leads it to this open question of, like, is radical thought poetry? Where I was, the earworm at once seems to be of a piece with other types of non-functional thought or non-useful, whatever you want to call it. And as you're mentioning, you know, cognitive capitalism's in there just trying to scoop as much as it can. So, like, my thought is, well, Is the earworm something to be mined by contemporary capitalism? But there's also in your work, or in the, especially in this chapter, no, I would say throughout, there's something of the excess where it's just like, as you're calling it, the unruly, which has that potential for the radical spin. I think on my end, I'm gonna have to leave it open if it's poetry, but I'll have to mull on that a little more.
Yeah, it is. I don't know that I actually come to a conclusion, but it's
sure. Yeah.
It's the offering, I guess, that it's mm-hmm. like if this is what radical thought looks like, can we sure. be happy with it? And I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's something about, like, if you were able to tie this into a nice knot, it'd be, you know, something that you could just, like, hand over to capital to continue. You know what I mean? Like, if it were so simple, it would have already been co-opted, you know? But you're, something about it is kind of lending it to this open-endedness.
That's right. That's right. I think that's, to me, that's, I don't know if it's exactly a paradox so much as it is the... the self-contradicting nature of an earworm repetition to crystallize something, but to then, as you know, if you're a Deleuzian, you read that repetition is actually kind of an expression of difference, right? So something that is highly repetitive, like an earworm, actually doing some work to express difference, and that's really weird.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it points us right to that kind of. The contradiction of sense and no, that's great. I guess to take a little, leave the earworm and exchange it for a different type of worm, and to get to your hodgepodge of theory, what do you want to tell us about Upstream Color, which is a fantastically wacky film?
Oh yeah, that was a strange piece of cinema that I think that actually came out in 2013, if I remember correctly.
Right with your first book.
Yeah. So I started writing something about that film shortly after it came out, and eventually it became this chapter. Upstream Color is this strange film by Shane Carruth about what happens when I was trying to find it difficult to describe that film, but it follows the life cycle of a parasite, a worm that is used by someone who just goes in the credits by the name Thief to drug essentially and hypnotize or mesmerize a victim who he then bilks their life savings from. And eventually the people he hypnotizes or infects with these worms, they're drawn to a fellow who draws the worms out of their body, puts them in his pigs because he's a pig farmer. And it turns out that he's also not just a pig farmer, but a composer. And when his pigs have piglets, the worms are in the parasites are in the piglets. He throws the piglets into a stream. And the parasites eventually wash downstream, get absorbed into the roots of these orchids that grow on the riverside and color the orchids blue. Now, I mean, that's sort of the life cycle of the worm.
And in the orchids is the worm that Thief harvests.
The orchids is the worm. And then,
or he buys the worm from the people who harvest it from the orchid, right?
That's right. That's correct. Yeah. So we learned that at the end that the orchids were purchased by this guy, the thief. And but there's much more that happens between two people who meet each other, and they learn, or they kind of learn, that they were both infected in the same way, and they've developed a strange kind of connection to these pigs that host their former worm. So I guess that the film is strange enough, so I tried to figure out a way to write about that film and write about the way in which the worm manifests a refrain. I think I actually call the chapter The Worm Refrain. And the way we understand it, I understand a refrain is from Deleuze and Guattari's idea of it's a kind of a rhythm that is not necessarily metrical, but it is a way, it's a kind of periodicity that connects other types of disparate phenomena together. And ultimately, what I described with this life cycle of the worm that captures other people, other people's desires, their insecurities, and their sense of self is sort of taken over by this worm refrain, becomes a way of understanding how we can live through that kind of abstraction. And ultimately, I talk about the ways in which the characters in the film experience a loss of themselves, and the nature of habit is how they have to try to regenerate their sense of self. And I talk a little bit about Deleuze's ideas of habit being a kind of larval self. I think that's near the end of the chapter. It's a strange film, and it's actually a strange chapter. Kind of, I suppose, the nature of that chapter leads into it reveals some of the voice of the other side of the book, perhaps in a way that the previous two chapters don't.
Yeah, no, that's yeah, I think you refer to this one as it combined with what you might call a hodgepodge of theory, which marks a step away from a little bit more of the discursive. I'm going to hear the thinkers I'm engaging with. Here are some of their thoughts. Here are my tweaks. Here are my radicalizations. And this there's less of a trying to create a holistic argument, but just kind of like thinking through this film, as you're saying, and trying to make sense of
the form of this chapter is a constellation, I suppose. Use that kind of Benjaminian idea, although I wasn't thinking explicitly about that, but it is really a constellation of thoughts that in some sense, augur the flip side of the book.
Sure. No, and that sounds like a good segue. As I kind of mentioned earlier, I had a little trouble, kind of figuring out how to fit this second half, this a little bit more amorphous, dream-esque event into the, I guess, kind of like the medium of, or the fourth, the type of structure that we've been going back and forth with, where you kind of go, hey, here's what I'm talking about. Here's a complete thing. Whereas the event side is a little bit more explicitly trying to like pull out this, to make a very simple contrast between like, even though the first chapter was talking about something like becoming, it was still kind of, it was written in the mode of being, I'm more or less, using expository prose, whereas the second one really takes that, the idea of becoming, and enacts it in a way as it's trying to unpack some of these things. So I guess to give the due credit, my opening spiel about the metaboly and the stealing words that I wish I was, that I had written, are pulled from this second half, but that was my way of kind of roping it in. So instead of, I guess, giving away the punchline, which there isn't so much, which is kind of hard, it's all in the setup. So I thought you might give us a little bit more of a setup. So for the listeners and hopefully future readers of this event side, could you give us a little introduction to it, a little explanation what you're trying to wander through?
Maybe I can talk about some of the conditions for the emergence of these chapters. I think at some point I had been reading a lot of Gaston Bachelard's work, and I don't know, again, he's like Langer, someone who is very popular in the 20th century, but then his work seems to have faded largely from contemporary philosophy, contemporary theory. But he was a philosopher of science in his first half of his career, and then the latter half of his career, he started writing about the imagination and developed a kind of philosophy of the imagination. And he goes through, he was a bizarre writer. He would write about really obscure, unknown thinkers, poets, And he would grab parts of their work instead of doing this kind of expository, as we said, a kind of expository work, excuse me, to unpack a poem, right? He would just say, look, here are these images. And he would work with images and then develop this prose around a little fragmented image as a way to try to talk about the kind of phenomenology of the imagination. And one place he suggests that the way to talk about images, the way to talk about the imagination is to use the imagination, right? Essentially, that's what he said. He puts it in a different way, but essentially says like to dream about, to talk about a dream, you have to dream and essentially do the kind of dream, right? So this is the kind of work that I set out to do with these chapters. And these chapters were written over a couple of years, actually, and workshopped at this Tuning Speculation conference that I mentioned that I put on with the members of the Occulture. And I presented them in other places. So they always had a certain... Sorry, I don't know if you can hear that. Someone's texting me. It's interrupting.
They're just little earworms. Little background. It's quite all right. Contemporary capitalism, we can twist that in at the end, I'm sure.
Right. Okay. So where was I? So these... Essentially, I guess in the book, I referred to them as reveries, as little dreams. And I suppose drawing on some of the work that I did with the Occulture and ludic dreaming, I said, well, let's take up the idea of dreaming again as the driving logic. And so in some sense, the thoughts are constellated, but there's more of a kind of concatenation between one thought and another, and how another thought dovetails with another thought, not because it is logically sound, but perhaps because there is a... let's say like even a rhyme, there's a rhythm in the text that I'm using that then actually spurs a kind of discussion of rhythm itself via, for example, I think I talk about Virginia Woolf's use of rhythm, and I start taking up a kind of rhythmic way of writing, and to also suggest that rhythm is something that entails a kind of unrhythmness, arrhythmness as well. So I wouldn't call it poetry, but I'd say that there is a poetic sensibility that drives this, right? If we want to say that part of what drives poetry is rhythm, is pace, is tone. There's wordplay as well. I think for me, it's, I suppose I try to, with those thoughts about earworms, about animal mentality that we mentioned, I also talk about listening to melodies backwards in time, which is another idea that Bachelard had. That these are ways in which you can talk about them non-linearly, right? And so the entire gambit, let's say, the event side of the work is to try to understand actually how thinking is a process, and sometimes it's recursive. And so this is where I suppose I take up the earworms, the logic of the earworm as this recursive repeating thing that kind of modulates fragments, stops, starts, goes away, comes back a little bit differently. Maybe it's in a different key than the actual key you would hear it on the recording. As I said, there's the repetition is an expression of some kind of difference happening. So what are the ways that we can twist this and let thinking unfurl itself, not by making sense, but by making a kind of nonsense? And if you're, again, if you're a Deleuzian, this idea of nonsense is not a nothingness. It's often an abundance of sense, an overabundance of sense. So I don't know if that clarifies it or just makes it a little bit more dreamy, what I've just said.
No, I think that's a fantastic introduction. It's a very dreamy passage, you know, but you provided, like I said, as I kind of asked, hopefully listeners coming to it can get a sense of something what you're doing, because it's not, you know, it, I guess to like to help, I guess, picture it a little bit. It's not, it's, you know, it's not, say, like, it's not just like random syllables, you know, there are thoughts, but it's like watching these. It isn't necessarily nonsense, but it isn't also sense. And it's kind of playing with little fragments of things that kind of, I guess make sense. And just kind of seeing how they play out, you know? So it's not quite stream of consciousness, but also kind of stream of consciousness, you know? So it is this kind of nice balance between, I don't know. I really appreciated how it had something of a discursive unfolding, you know, like, it's not like I was reading, you know, James Joyce and you're talking about a moo cow or something, you know, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? You know, I could follow it, but also there was, it struck a nice balance between giving me something, me as a reader, I guess, you know, to kind of like think about on the sense side, but also allowing it space in order to kind of wander in these kind of, yeah. So I think that's a beautiful,
I mean, I think I probably took the actual idea of discursiveness, maybe too seriously in, or too literally, you know, the idea of discursiveness is a kind of wandering, right, from one topic to another. And so, wandering is probably a great way of describing it, because when you wander, you're not nowhere. When you're always somewhere, but the somewhere is not necessarily the destination. It's not necessarily where you planned to be, but it follows from where you came, right? And there's a kind of sense that gets dragged along or made out of it, maybe after the fact. And I play with that a little bit as well. And again, that's this kind of logic of the earworm, I suppose. There's a kind of recursivity of thinking that takes place through this writing, and a way of trying to show writing as a kind of recursive practice as well.
Sure. Right. Yeah. No, I guess another adjective that I would want to throw with wandering is it's like a purposeful, you're following a line. You're not following nothing. It's not chaos, but it's allowing the wandering to kind of, you know, unfold. Beautiful. Well, we're coming up on about an hour, and I just wanted to make sure that I give you the opportunity. Are there any other things you're currently working on, or anything else? First of all, anything else you want to say about the book? If there's anything we missed in our quick pass, but also what is it opening up onto in your future?
I think what it's, I don't know that I, what else I can say about the book. Like there's some interesting parts about mimes and zombies that
make. Yeah, what was it? The amount of sense in the world is directly proportional to the number of mimes or something. There's some quote in there. Yeah.
That sounds right. No, this book is set up. I think the new direction that I'm working in is dealing with daydreams a little bit more specifically, a project that I started a couple of years ago, and it's going to become intensified in the next coming years, is just looking at this idea of daydreaming also as a kind of useless thinking. But in the past, let's say 10 years, daydreaming has, like the earworm in some way, it's been rendered functional. It's been rendered functional because there was a discovery made in the early 2000s about when the brain is at rest, there's a kind of network that lights up. And scientists, being positivists, have to understand that this must be good for something, and appeal to the kind of evolutionary justification that if the brain has a coherent network when it's not being tasked specifically thinking something, it must be doing something for some good. And the psychological correlate to that resting brain state is the determined mind wandering, right, or daydreaming as some kind of absent-mindedness. And then very quickly, it was understood that, okay, well, what's going on? This must be good for something. It seems to be ways of daydreaming seems to be a way of consolidating the self, rehearsing for the future, generating us, you know, kind of tonus of the body that gives us our sense of place in the world. I think all that's fantastic and arguably reasonable, but I think there's a critical side missing that overlooks the fact that these were useless, like idleness, daydreaming have historically been useless moments. And maybe actually to get back to this idea of radical thought being a kind of aspiration, as you know, Baudrillard suggested, it's an aspiration that we can have once we hive off the things like calculation and reckoning to machines. What do we have left? We have thinking that doesn't necessarily make sense, thinking that makes instead poetry, right? So I'm not trying to be romantic and saying like we should keep daydreaming as a useless activity, but I do think that there is something about reverie and thought that doesn't produce anything that is perhaps still important in the world. And maybe that does make me seem kind of like an old fashioned modernist in some way, that there's, you know, it almost sounds like art for art's sake. Thought for thought's sake, we could say, is a way of putting it. You know, so I'm just in the preliminary parts of this writing right now. I'm still working with Langer's ideas. She developed a theory of mind in her later life that has some interesting ways of dealing with the fact that the mind is continuous with biological rhythms, and if these biological rhythms are not being captured by habit, by various forms of life, then what, we still have an activity going on, right? There's still processes going on, but what are these processes doing? And I'm actually interested in understanding that, not as it's necessarily for the functional purpose, but for the fact that there this is another kind of excess, right?
Yeah, no, and it's a, you know, it's a, all I was, I thought about, I don't know if this makes it more romantic or not, or more utopian, but the, you know, the kind of thought experiment of like, what would what's the role of thought in humans, and like something like a fully automated, you know, communism, you know, like, so say all of the, you know, the capital's exploitative, you know, means have been taken care of, and we, you know, develop the robots that can, they can give me my hamburger, and you know, how do we construct a meaningful life, and what role does thought have that isn't necessarily just, you know, I guess, so I don't know if ends driven is the correct way to put it, but no, sure. I think that's a incredibly rich you know, place to be inhabiting. So yeah, that's great.
And I think it's complicated because there seems to be this interest in daydreaming now in a way that there hasn't been, but it's happening at a time when we seem to have less time to do it, right? There's our social media, et cetera, the other types of media that we have are always sort of capturing attention. Some way I think that that attention is being captured so quickly and always moved from one thing to another that it's going to achieve a kind of escape velocity that we thought will actually lift off from, and this sounds totally ridiculous, but I kind of like it, the thought will lift off from its material conditions and can finally escape into not having to be itself.
Yeah, no, that just to tie in, I guess, one other author we didn't really mention here today, but he's wacky, and I like him, and you mentioned him a little bit. It reminds, just hearing you talk about that, I guess my own comment as well, the Willem Flusser's, the Into the World of the Technical Image, or I'm blanking on the exact title, but it's like a speculative, like, writing in the future about how the we'll just be hooked up to apparatuses constantly producing information, and it's a very fun and wacky book, the idea of it lifting from its material conditions is I think it resonates nicely with that.
Great. Cool.
That's all I have here.
That's just fantastic.
Yeah, I just want to thank you so much. It was a lovely book. It was fantastic talking to you. And Yeah, we hope to have you when your daydreams enter a book form once again, or I guess maybe whatever form it takes. I'm sure we'd be happy to have you back on the show.
Great. Thank you so much. And again, thanks for inviting me to have this chat. And thank you for reading the book, actually, as well.
Yeah, no, it was great. It's my pleasure. So
great.
All right.
All right, Nathan, take care.
Thank you.